I'm hitting record.
Okay.
All right. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Conversations with Rookie, where I talk about different things with different people. And today is it's going to be a very interesting episode with someone that has known me my whole life, basically. So I have my dad here. So welcome to the podcast, Daddy.
Thank you very much, Rookie.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay.
Yeah. So how would you introduce yourself? How would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Okay. My name is Fidelis Akpogiran. I was born 9th September 1963.
Okay, that's going to be important later on.
Okay.
And then keep going.
Yes, so Inoha, in Upper Local Government of Delta State.
Okay.
Of note, I was born the year Nigeria became a republic. Nigeria gained independence in 1960, 3 years later. In 1960, when Nigeria gained independence, what it meant was that the Queen of England was still officially the head of the country until Nigeria became a republic. And that's when we had a head of state, as it were, and the Queen of England stopped being the head of state of Nigeria. So that's the year I was born, in an epochal year for the country. Thank you.
All right, so what do you do? What's your day job? What are your hobbies?
Okay. I read system engineering. I practice in a career spanning first in the industry of a branch automation for bank during the greater part of my career, spanning 25 years in the oil and gas industry. And I retired officially 2019, but I'm still doing work in the oil and gas industry post-retirement. So I'm still very active, still working, and still happy.
Okay, that's good. So today we're going to be talking about, you know, Nigeria, yesterday, today, and, you know, what's going on, like, where are we? So much is happening. But Daddy, before I go on, every time someone comes on the podcast, I always like tell them, or I always like give a story of how I know them or where I met them. So I'm going to say how I met you, and you're going to say how you met me. So basically, I don't know. You've always been there, but because I didn't actually meet you in any way, right? I met you when I was born, and you gave birth to me, basically made me. But because I don't have like a how I met you story, I'm going to say like my earliest memory of you. So I think when I think furthest back, my earliest memory of you is like when you would come back from work and me and Egon will come and remove your shoe and take your socks and take it inside the house. And then I also remember when you used to put us on your laps and like rock us and sing. That's I think that's like my very earliest memory of you. Do you remember that?
Talking about how we met, I think I met you even before you were born.
Really?
Okay. Yes, I think it's a strange story. I was a shell that time, only a few years into the company. That was 1997. I had come at work and was resting. I didn't take in my dinner and was resting. Your mother was pregnant with you at that time. I was watching TV, listening to news. I think I slept off. And when I woke, I had you showed me and you told me your name.
I told you my name.
Yes, you told me your name, that this Bene Rukeri.
Wow. So you saw like a baby in the, you saw like a toddler in the dream.
The toddler, I saw a toddler and you said your name is Bene Rukeri.
Wow.
And I woke up and I told your mom, baby say no. And that's the name you are being. So,
when I was born.
That's where it starts.
Okay. So, what were your first thoughts when? Huh?
I said came with your name.
Interesting. And it's something. My name is something I've been thinking about a lot lately, Daddy, because you know. Back home, people call me Rukere. And then, you know, when I came to the US, I started answering Rookie. And I've really been thinking about it, like, is this the name that I want to go by? So these days, when I sign emails, I always make sure I sign it as Ogene Rukere. Because I think it's easy, like, whenever you send out emails, you know, I always have my, like, signature at the bottom. And my signature is not Rookie. It's not Rukere. It's Ogene Rukere. And I'm always amused when, like, they write me back and they write out the full spelling, their Ogene Rukere. So I think that's a way for me to hold on to that name. But I don't know if Rookie, I feel like Rookie has been my name for the past, like, what, eight years coming to the US. So that's something I actually think about quite a lot. But now that you said that story, maybe I'll take it back and go by Ogene Rukere more. So another thing that I wanted to say, I was thinking about, was that when I was, you know, having this podcast and conversations and talking a lot, I feel like I got that from you. I think we're very alike. I think we're very alike, even in the things that we like. We're both introverts and things like that. But I remember, like, listening to you, and I don't know if I've ever told you this story, so that's why I wanted to tell you. I remember when I was much younger, I was listening to you talk, and when anybody would say something about history, about art, about science, anything, you always had something to say. And I was so blown away by that. Like, it didn't matter what topic they brought up, you would know about something about it, maybe not know the full thing. And then that was when I decided I want to read books. I don't know why I thought reading books would be what would help me, but I just decided that I was going to read books, read as many books as I can, so that I'll be like Daddy. So that if anybody ever brought up any conversation, sports, you know, history, I would have something to say. So that was what got me started reading books. That was the intention behind it, so that I could talk like you and sound like you and have strong arguments to give.
Okay. So I think it's, now, the reason being that my own father, who is was
a teacher,
a later master of a number of primary schools. And he was an avid reader. He was reading the classics. He studied just knowledge. He studied English. He studied philosophy. So I grew up in the midst of books. It was a fairly okay family. I mean, in terms of as much as a headmaster could take care of his family, so it was okay. But it was all about books. He read and read and read. When he came, see him reading over the weekend. And so I grew up in the culture of books. So for every book my father read, I also read it. Wow. And because he was a man of letters, he loved the Christian religious knowledge, he loved philosophy. He even had book in Latin, which I read as a young person. Way I occupied myself after school and on holidays was just to keep reading his books. He also political economy. He read a lot of books about Nigeria's independence, the independent struggle. Was a man of letters. The founder of the West African Pilot in those days.
Right. Yeah, didn't he also own a newspaper? Yeah. Right.
So to a technical school. That's the where we focused on sciences. The Benin Science College. So my formal education, I was science focused. When I came home, literary things around. And then my father also buying a newspaper every day and reading. The culture of newspaper was very strong at that time in the 60s. And apart from radio, that was the only way you could hear news about the country, read news analysis, editorial opinions of the newspaper he bought and had read. I also followed him. He also made a point of even underlining the important points in those articles he read. So unconsciously, I followed this path in the literary interest. And then I saw myself tilting towards science because of my formal education. So you could say that I was the child of both worlds. You could say that. So maybe that is, and it just happened that I grew up with the interest. There is this tale when he finally retired from teaching, and we moved from Efru Iwori that time to the village. We had to pack his things to the village. People were expecting that, having spent decades in the town, we're going to come with a lot of properties. But as we're packing home, the villagers were saying, these people, they're not coming with any property, they're only coming with books. So we ended up packing the village with only books and tons of books, which my father retired home to the village. So it's a work. I still love reading, but not as much as I used to. But
yeah.
I mean, you know that I still buy a lot of books, even if I don't
read. I know.
It's something that I love doing, and it changes. Changes your world. It helps you with the
critical thinking. It's
very important. That's it.
Yeah. So wasn't Papa also like an orator? I think I heard the story of him being like an.
Yes, indeed. He was a man of letters. He spoke English very well and was very pronunciation. I was in school, the story goes that in those days you don't have in the 70s when we were. I was in Benin Technical College from 1974. When I did my work and graduated afterward, there were a number of times you don't have, and even phones were not accessible. So if you needed something, you wrote a letter, you put a stamp, you went
and you sent it post office.
You know, well, I was in the body house, so I wouldn't be, but you went to the mailing room, you gave it to the mailing person. They went posted in the post office. So he will keep that letter. He will not show me all the mistakes I made writing to him. He was that careful. So he loved languages. He loved the Yoruba language. He insisted on the right pronunciation, the right spellings. And he was patient about American.
Well,
American organization with a Z.
With a Z.
Yes. Patient when people didn't know the difference between spelling
English language
and the American way of spelling it. And then he also understood the Yoruba language. I mean, was the translator. Mm-hmm. So when we used to have missionary priests, at that time there were a number of missionaries. So when the Irish missionary priest would stand up during the gospel and be preaching, the Papa would come in and be translating into Yoruba language. At the point, his translation was so interesting that people listen more. It's as if he was the person preaching to what he was. In Yoruba language than in English.
Yeah.
So and vice versa. So when he also, there were traditional ceremonies, which traditional chief or the village head who speak in Urhobo, who will translate to English. So he was well known, became a member of the Urhobo Language Committee, who now undertook the translation of the Bible from into.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he did all that work. So he was a man of letters, he was an orator. I don't think any of us were able to emulate him to that extent.
Yeah.
We just very well somebody who could hold a crowd through what he said, through his oration. And when he made a speech, it will all end up with an applause. And he had this very beautiful that. So when I wrote to him from the house asking for money, asking for this, he kept the old letter I had written, and then first and foremost, he would start with my ugly handwriting, then correct. And I think some of you rubbed off on me, on you people, and how I insist on some things. I'm sure you
yeah.
That in my own.
Yeah, no, I remember when we were small, like every summer you used to make us buy books, and you have us like buy a number of books that we would read. And I think that was when I got to know about like African Writer Series, Cyprian Equency, Chimamanda. Like those were the first times I ever read those books. So I really appreciate it. And you know, then, and it's so funny because I think everyone in the house sort of reads now. I know Eru is a big reader. Even Egbono reads. He started reading more when he went to secondary school. Read mostly like, you know, fiction, anime, novels and things like that. But one thing that I do appreciate is like reading actually helps you communicate thoughts. And communicating thoughts had never been a problem for me, but it was when I left and, you know, you talked to people and like, I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to say what that, but when you're actually a reader, you actually know how to bring what is on the inside of you out in colorful expression. So that's something I appreciate about growing up.
Indeed.
Yeah. What about, so another thing I'm curious about that is your argumentative side. You're very argumentative. And that can be heard mostly when you're talking to Uncle Godwin or your late friend Uncle Festus. What how was that developed, and why do you have a passion?
Call it argumentative. I would say it's critical. The ability to think independent of the nuances, the emotions. You know, when there is an issue at hand, you want to be able to take out all the emotions, all the fibers of, and then look at the clear facts in which what is the interest at stake, because I won't color the facts. Emotion
That's
can
true.
Overlay itself. So where does that come from? Well, my father was a big, so as a headmaster, you could understand that he was dealing with of pupils and even teachers and even school administrator.
Yeah.
Then at a point, he now became the head of his family at Ohio. Even while he was in the front teaching, issues would come and see him in the house. And I was always around, most day or while I was in primary school before I went to boarding house. And a bit of listening, and then very critical question. So, and his question, the rule of law. So the concept of about courts, going to court, it's about what is the right thing that ought to be done in this case. So maybe it was a case of marriage between a couple or the case of property sharing. So the first clarity, what is the procedure? What is the right thing to do? And then whatever discussion you had, he will win. Is this what we ought to do? Did you do the right thing? So it unconsciously, while being associated with him, while listening to him, while being around him, it became clear to me that, you know, some people come to him to bring cases.
Yeah.
To report matter. And after he has asked one or two questions, three questions, In many cases, the people go home and say, look, I was wrong, even without the other party being called, because he will ask you some. So in most of these discussions, because we overlay it with emotions, we overlay the fact with emotions, with personal interest, it becomes very difficult to have sensible conversation. So the way, the approach I have to conversation is here. What problem are we trying to solve? Whose interest? Are we being fair to all parties? Ask yourself, are we being fair to all? Do we even understand your point? The silent voice, the person who has no opportunity to be heard, have we been able to place ourselves in the shoes of that person, in the mind of that person, that person's rationale? So by the time you play up the other person, it's flip-flopping, it's falling apart. So I think it's that sense of critical thinking, asking the questions. Everybody is represented in, if everybody is represented in, if everybody's point of view are on the table, whether they are there or not. So that's where I believe the discussions I have with the late Festus, Brad Godwin, people associate with, it's about critical thinking. It's about asking, about making sure every viewpoint is fairly. And at the end of the day, by the time you ask these questions, it becomes clear that a lot of the things we are dealing with are just emotions and personal biases. That's what comes out in many cases.
It is, but so it means like when you're called to judge a matter, sometimes a lot of people are not happy because you're able to sort of pick through these issues, and you know, it makes you seem like you are maybe. It could be very tough, right? It's not an easy place to be, but it's a good place to be. So I want to ask you, like, what was Nigeria growing up like, you know, growing up in that time? What were some things that, you know, happened then? Because again, I always say that we didn't really grow up to see a functional government, right? By the time I was young, you know, you couldn't really, or you didn't want to, if you had the means, you didn't want to send your children to, you know, public schools. You know, back then, federal universities in Nigeria were some of the best universities in Africa and the world. You know, our professors were invited for conferences all around the world. They were highly respected. You know, there was a lot of research going on there in all fields. So what was it like growing up there? So for people like me and my friends who listen, who experienced that, What are some things that we missed out on?
Okay. You missed out on government. You missed out on the basic needs of the people. Mm. It had little to do with military or civilian. Let me say that. Okay. Like I told you, I was years old, which is the early 60s. And then advantage of being a headmaster's child to school. So at the age of four, although I was not formally already going to school with him. And at that very early, they called them the Roman Catholic Mission. So the missionary
mission
and then the early schools, the
local schools,
and so on. So organizations, the Anglicans, the Baptist Church, the Methodist Church, they had their schools, and then the government, local authority, which we now call local government, had their schools. And they had uniform curriculum, and I could remember education inspectors coming to those schools. It was like a big deal. Yes, it was a big deal when the education would come to that school. It was a big deal. Just preparing the students, teaching them. We used to have a subject called a nature study that time. And that subject required us to understand the things of nature, taught us about butterfly. We came with, so they said, okay, go and bring a butterfly. The teacher will bring a butterfly. So it was an interesting time. The learning was very basic, very rudimentary. And surprisingly, the first few years of the primary education was in vernacular. They taught, yes, they taught us in Urhobo language.
Wow.
They taught us the vowels and consonants of the Urhobo language. And it made sense. Once we understood the subject I talked about, nature study, about social studies, and rhymes and nurseries in Urhobo language. I still remember.
That's so important.
Yes, indeed. And they taught you some morals. And those things still last in you. We still use them. My friends with Windows, they still use them. We still use them to remind each other about things.
Wow. So
it was an education that was very close to people, to the local culture, to the indigenous people at that time. Later on, the missionary schools, I think that was in this, and then a great part of the curriculum was in, they changed a lot of things, but it still didn't do less or interrupted things. So from 1967 to 1970, interrupted education. It was no longer steady. In one of the times at Oha, we were told that the Biafra forces were close to Asaba, and then all the people started to run into the bush. We came back. So basically, it was an interesting thing. Then, at that time, we had 12 states of the Federation, and where we called
Delta
was Eastern Region. Later, it became Bendem. And then there was pipe-borne water in the village under the government of Ogbemudia. They gave us water so you could go to the public tap and you fetched water.
Mm.
There was an organization, a corporation called Water Resources. They pumped water and people had pipe-borne water. Not in their houses, but publicly. So you could go to the public tap, properly mounted, and you fetched water for drinking.
Yeah.
Then they also had this educational television. Television was not very common, it was black and white television. But the Midwestern government at that time, at the local government headquarters, which is Orerukpe, they set up a viewing center, they mounted the television there. And as specific, we'll have educational programs on the television, and all the students, pupils will line up to the view center, sit down there and listen to the broadcast. And the teacher required us to take our notes. Then we did the homework and reported back to the teacher.
So those programs, they were intentionally made for students at that age to communicate what it is that they wanted to communicate, right?
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah. So if they had a particular message for youths at that time, they also used that opportunity. Mostly they directed the messages to hygiene, because there were a lot of issues around hygiene that time. And so they used it as also a form for educating the youths, for connecting with the youths and giving them a common message, a common content. Yeah. So if there is an developing and the government wanted to talk to the youths very quickly, it was the Bendem television at that time. So
can I ask a question? Is it fair to say that then a lot of information was localized? So how was communication with other states? Because if young children are learning in vernacular, which may be good for them, being that they are from that region, right? How was communication with other states? How aware were you about maybe Lagos or Abuja or River States? You know, I'm sure you were younger then, but around that time, was there a lot of cross, you know, intermarriages or people traveling here and there, or was it very localized?
It was a combination of both. So we had education about our local environment, local parables, local folklores, local stories, even local crafts. So making brooms, making empty wear pots. But then we also had some very broad curriculum, especially social studies.
Okay.
So in social studies, we study the various cultures in Nigeria. We studied about the Nupes, we studied about the Efits, we studied about the Hausas. We even studied about West Africa later on in secondary school. Yes, then we also did the civic education. At that time, you will probably be punished if you could not recite who were the governors of the 12 states of Nigeria. Through rote learning, through memorizing, you had to know the 12 states, the governors of each of the 12 states of Nigeria, and
who the capital.
The yes, the capital of each state, the ministers. And then later on, when it became 19 states, whether it's mostly that time were military rule. Later, when it became 19 states, you have to be the governor of all the 19 states, the state capitals. And then so the curriculum had a national aspect in terms of social study, even in Africa. So we learned about Africa, the rhyme about the rivers of Africa. That's where we learned it in primary school. We learned about the rivers of Africa. So it had a broad aspect, a pan-Nigerian aspect, and a very local one. So it was a very broad thing, interesting curriculum. Yes.
So that's very interesting, because it's funny, because when after I left left Nigeria, and I realized that we don't know a lot about our brothers in other African states or African countries, and it's something that I didn't learn in school. I didn't learn about Africa, I didn't learn about the Civil War, I didn't learn about the history. I think most of what I learned was just dates and times. Oh, this was the first president. The coup was on this day, but we didn't learn what the history, what the background was like. We learned about colonization, but we didn't learn how it started and all the factors and players. Like, those things were never thought. And so I think it was later on in books, in movies, in documentaries, that I actually began to really learn about, Nigeria. But we did learn about like different cultures, mostly their dressing, mostly their food. We didn't even learn about their migration, how we came to be. Like those, I think those sort of basic important stories, right? We didn't really learn about that when I was in school.
Yeah, indeed. So because at that time, a lot of things had changed. At the beginning, there was a conscious effort to unite the country, starting from the young people, the minds of the young people. So as a primary school pupil at that time, and maybe later in secondary school, the first year of secondary school, you learned about the three major regions at that time. The northern, well, later on became four, which is the Midwestern region. You learned about Osadebe, you learned about Obafemi Awolowo, you learned about Nnamdi Azikiwe, and later Michael Obara, and then you learned about Tafawa Balewa, and then Sokoto. So you read about their history, about their briefly, then you learned about independence giants like Anthony Nahoro. So in the curriculum, there was a deliberate effort to build into the minds of people a country that was emerging, that was coming. And then with people, these pre- and post-independence leaders, we're being taught to us as role models. So it was when the Civil War broke out that there was a lot of negativity in the air. Suddenly, people who were heroes before no longer became heroes.
Depending on what side you're on.
Exactly. And then we began to see the terrible thing about the war. We saw pictures, later on we saw pictures, especially Kwashoko in the East, where there was so much hunger. So that thing threw it over the country. And so the fault lines began. So it's not as if everything was rosy and shiny.
Yeah.
Things were very basic, but things were a lot simpler. In the 70s, visiting Bende State at that time with the Togolese president, Eyadema, Nasigbe Eyadema at that time. It was a big ceremony. the women and all cultural groups will come and they visited Ororokpe. They took the trouble to go to communities.
Wow.
Somebody like Awolowo, when he was the premier of Western region, went to the remotest place in the Midwestern region that I wish consists of the whole of the Southwest and the most of and the all of Bende, which is Edo and Delta.
Yeah.
And I remember at a point he came to Agbaro, which is my maternal place, and the community received him. And there were speeches. My father was even translated from Urubu to English at that time. Gowon visited Orero. It's way out of
Yes,
and he came with a foreign head of state, Nasigbe Iyadema, and they taught us the French how to greet in French. Vive Nigeria, vive Togolese, vive Togo. So long live Nigeria, long live Togo. And we will stand waving flags at the two of them. They came in open back vans.
Wow.
In the sun, and they will ride past. So it was life was simpler, but the government was closer to people then. The government was closer to people. And there was, as a result, we what you will now call an unusual sense of patriotism.
Mm.
Up with for your generation, wondering why why we still love the country so much.
Yeah.
Because the country raised us to believe that.
Wow.
In the secondary school, we were taught apartheid was part of our social studies.
We'd never learned about apartheid.
Yes, we were told about apartheid, and they actually, at that time in Benin Technical College, brought some of this. South Africa to come and school with us. And then you could call it indoctrination. They taught us about Nelson Mandela, Steve Biko, and the struggles that the Africans were having to liberate themselves. We learned about the independence of many of how Ghana was one of the first West African countries to gain independence in 1957, later on Nigeria, later on Togo.
Did you learn about the slave trade?
Oh, of course, the slave trade was part of history.
Wow.
It was part of our curriculum. There was one very popular history book at that time. I've forgotten the name. Where you did read about it. So the education was very balanced, and it was Pan-African. So that's where you first of all, even the cultures of the people, that's where you first of all learn about the cultures of the Igbos, especially the Arochukwu, the long deity and all that. So you learned about even the various warriors in the north, Queen Amina, who was also in the north as a warrior, and all those people. You learned about Mali, that famous king in Mali. So it was a very broad, interesting education. I think what changed was that because there was now a national effort to introduce more science and technology, they dropped, because in those days they were called grammar schools, many schools.
Yeah, they were not.
Yes. So as after the Civil War, when they began to do national development policies, long-term development policies, moving towards technology, introducing refineries, introducing petroleum, a lot began to shift towards the sciences, and they began to this broad-based social political education that that was pre-independence and post-independence. So also, when the 633 form of education came, finished your junior secondary school, you branched out very early.
Yeah.
You understand? So things changed. Things moved on. The world began to be more technological, and Nigeria also suited the curriculum. So, but we had the advantage of broad-based literary education, sociopolitical education, even studying the geography of the entire Africa. I don't think the people of this generation will have that luxury.
But when I got to secondary school and I started learning geography, Unfortunately, a lot of our geography was British geography. So we're learning about, you know, because we went to British schools, right? So, you know, when I was growing up, British schools were the best schools. And in hindsight, was it really, right? They were, and, you know, your children too, and things like that. And, you know, parents will do their best by their children and send them. And we learn about like Bristol and Wales and Scotland, and all these things that, now that I think about it, I never remembered, didn't make sense, and was just out of place. So, you know, we would learn about, like, you know, the geography, and even in our economy classes was British economy, which doesn't make sense now that I think about it. But it's like, why are we learning about British economy? Why are we learning about all these things that don't really help us? You know, I think what I sense from where your from your education is that there was an intentional effort to raise leaders that will sort of take the country on, right? Because it's an emerging country, so you show them the future, you show them the past, show them what could be, you know. But I think my generation was primed to leave Nigeria, right? Someone said that the Nigerian dream is to go to Canada right now. But before we get there, right, so you went through secondary school, and how was it like getting into university, and what were your dreams early on? What were your hopes and aspirations for Nigeria? Because another thing I'm also curious about is why you stayed back. You know, a lot of people left when they had the opportunity to. You had the opportunity to travel to different countries and be exposed in that way back then. Why did you stay back, and why did you decide, I'm going to, you know, raise my family here and all that?
Okay, so my university education, I finished from the University of Benin. Later on, I did a lot of master's degree in various schools over the world. So initially, I had applied to read electrical engineering, but I had initially been admitted to read electrical engineering at Auchi Polytechnic. My father said, no, please go to University of Benin. So I got there, had qualified, was on the path of being admitted. Then I saw a friend. At that time, that was 87, a bit late also into university. I saw a friend who, that time, they just established the Institute of Computer Science at University of Benin. And UNESCO had just brought so many beautiful computers to the department. And I saw a friend there after coming from the Faculty of Engineering. I went to see him, and he says, I'm reading computer science. I said, computer science? So the thing just triggered in my brain. And so went back, took my form again, changed the course, and then that was how I ended up reading computer science. And later on, specialized in systems engineering.
Was that your first like interaction with computers, or did you have previous prior interaction with computers?
Where would you see computers? Oh my goodness! You think computers were as ubiquitous as they are?
I mean, I was curious because it was more like intrigue, right?
Yes, I was intrigued when the FID was. You know that is really computer science, and they had a computer lab. You know, laptop carrying all over the place. There's a computer lab. You booked a slot to go there and use the computer. That time was the era of mainframes. Later on, the school brought on desktop computers, which were the DOS, MS-DOS machines. You use those flop. You can't imagine it. So you can't imagine it. So, and he took me into the computer center, and I saw all kinds of dazzling things and all that. I just forgot about electrical engineering.
So that, but I'm curious now, what were computers for then, right? Because my understanding of computer is like internet, type documents, you know, your computers can do pretty much anything now, book things online, online shopping, Amazon. What were those computers for? Because I'm sure you didn't have like a user interface the way that, you know, we had beautiful icons and pictures. It was mostly maybe command line.
Yeah, it was a command line thing. we had all kinds of operating systems. By the way, Microsoft was just burgeoning. It was just coming newly with Apple, the Macintosh. So the real computing then was by IBM, Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah.
Yes, so, and they had huge mainframe, mini frames, and everything you wanted to do, you typed it as a command.
Interesting. So what are the things that you want to do though? Like what were they used for?
Data processing, for example. Yes, they were, you use it for data processing, like payroll processing. You use it to process payroll. Use it to process, you do statistical analysis. So if you had a lot of, a questionnaire, a survey, there was the package called SPSS, Statistical Package for Social Sciences.
Yeah.
You put it there and it will help you calculate all your standard deviation, regression analysis. And
then
the printout was this large paper there with a large printout. It's not this A4 paper, A4 came later. Roll, and you have to fold it. Then you could also use it to do, we in the scientific language, we had Fortran at that time, which we used to do scientific calculations. So if you want to do Monte Carlo calculation at that time, or you want to do iterative schemes like operations research, you now use Fortran language, you coded it manually, you ran it, you debugged it. So it was an interesting time.
Then so you had professors who like taught you these things and you know, this but then again, now that I think about it, it must have been quite isolating, right? Because when you're with your friends who maybe are reading law and you tell them what you like, you can't fully explain to them what you're doing. You just say, oh, I'm reading computer science. Is that how it was?
Somebody who asked me where I was.
Wow. So it was that much like right on the money, like ahead of the times.
And we were kind of a very special group of people, because later on it became obvious that computer was the way to go. At that time,
wow,
you wanted to access the internet, you did a dial-up, you hooked up your computer to a telephone line, then you hooked it up through a modem, and then the modem would make and then ring the other side, and then you to upload, you had a lot of protocols. You have to the protocol you upload.
This is exhausting.
So it was interesting. It was interesting. Sometimes the modern.
No, I think you're the real computer scientist, because the ones that are there these days, they don't really understand like the backbone of it. But you know that when another tech boom, right? When another tech boom where, like, you know, even people that are reading law, people that are reading art, like everyone's going into tech, data analysis, product design, UI, UX, Scrum manager, kind of thing. So it's like where a lot of people that I know that went to school for biology, went to school for different things, are now in tech, right? Everyone's learning coding. So it's like I think we're really at another tech boom. In a different way than maybe at that time.
Yeah, but ironically, the very fundamental things that were discovered in the 60s and 70s in the computing are the very things that are now the boom of the day.
Yeah.
Because let me give you some examples.
Okay.
In our days reading computer science, we did some courses, and there were a lot of sorting and searching algorithms that were taught at that time. If you had a whole pile of data, whether on structured or unstructured data, text or whatever, how do you sort it? You know, so you have to think in terms of the logic, and then you go and code it and you test it with some sample data.
Mm.
You know, so the Facebooks of this world, the Googles of this world, it is those.
They're based off of that.
Yeah, it's those same fundamental algorithm rules that they have been able to perfect on a very large scale. So nothing much. Fundamentally, it is still the discoveries of the 60s that are still artificial intelligence that is a big thing today. It has been there since the 60s. You understand?
Wow.
It has been there since the 60s. And the very principles of adaptive learning, of being able to develop a programming language that can learn data discover patterns from data.
Do you know that I think that is the bane, that's going to be the bane of our existence, the way that this technology that you're referring to is being used, right? And maybe bane is a very strong word, but what I mean is, like, what you're talking about, you know, being able to sort these principles is what Instagram has used. So let's say, you know, I like dogs, right? What keeps coming up on my page as I search is dogs, right? Sure. You like recipes, you like food recipes on Instagram because you always share it with us. It means that you keep seeing those same food recipes over and over more times than another person who maybe likes dogs. And guess what? It's intended to keep you there. So that whereas you would have spent 1 hour there, you're spending 2 hours there, right? And then you have other softwares that, or, you know, algorithms that are able to learn your habits and use that to market to you. So in a way, this technology is being used in sort of a manipulative way to squeeze out money from all of us in different ways and to make us accustomed to the things that, you know, they want us to do, so to speak, on Instagram. Like, they want you to stay, they want you to spend your money there, things like that.
Manipulative is a strong word. Say that it comes from the culture of customer preferences. What does the customer want?
Yeah.
So, and it has been a very basic principle of marketing, basically people in businesses. So, but understand that a customer is coming to using a particular tool, like in social media, and he has to understand the preferences, the individualized preferences.
Right.
It's about individualization, the individual preferences of that customer. And therefore, those tools begin to say, okay, this customer, for example, if you are scrolling and you stop at a particular frame, a particular picture, or a particular clip, and you spend some time there,
it's recorded. It's learning,
So by the time you now use these principles in computing to adapt and then being able to capture the customer preferences, you don't blame the developer for doing all that. How your mind works.
That's true. but it feels sort of like, you know, almost sinister in a way, like you're being, you know, it can feel like you're being watched, even though you're not, right? You're the one willingly giving your information via your habits and things like that. I think even my phone and my iPad, because they're both Apple and they're connected, and I usually carry them in my bag and come to work, I notice that every time I take my phone without my iPad, it tells me, you left your iPad at so-and-so location. So I'm just wondering, like, are you telling me to go back and get it? It just is interesting the way that technology is now being used and has changed over time.
It's called the Orwellian era, from George Orwell.
George Orwell, yeah.
Yes. Where the concept of the Big Brother comes from, and it was a predictive literature at that time, a very futuristic literature. When that book was written, and
did you read it?
Of course, I read George Orwell, 1984, The Big Brother. So it was based on the experiences of the Soviet era, where the Soviet Union at that time to understand what people were doing. They developed tools and systems to know people's mind, to even read and predict what they were going to do before they could do it. But unknown to us, it was also foretelling, foreseeing what Western civilization would do. So suddenly, surreptitiously, the Orwellian era has come upon us, and we don't know it. These days, if you are making a conversation on the phone, for example, I tried it with your mother one day, and she said, try it. She was telling me that once you are saying something,
yeah,
Facebook will make a request. She said, so I said, okay, I want a wristwatch. She said, I should specify what kind of wristwatch I want. And I said, Kevin Klein. And 15 minutes later, as I was scrolling through Facebook, and
you said a wristwatch.
They were advertising resources to me. And about a few minutes later, Kevin Klein resources started showing up. Up to today, I'm still seeing those resources. Until I buy, they probably won't stop.
They probably won't stop, yeah.
So that is the That is what has helped. Technology has been able to understand people's preferences and basically give you. So do you call it manipulation? I don't know, but
it's where we're at.
That is
interesting. So going through that and like coming out, right? So going through that, right, you're seeing the need for it. How was it like? So like that your friend asked, was it easy to find a job, or did you sort of go on to other things until maybe that market was ripe, or was it immediately ripe, like computer skills?
So getting job wasn't the problem in my era. When I finished the secondary school, I first of all did some courses in education, initially University of under the college education at that time. And I remember after I went to do my youth service, as a very young person, came back. And one day my father went to the Ministry of Education and said, he called me, said, Fidelis, you have finished your youth service, won't you go and apply? So I went to the education board in Europe at that time. I went there just with a photocopy of my youth service certificate and my qualification. On getting there, the man said, young man, where is your letter of application? I said, sir, am I supposed to write an application? He said, my friend, take a piece of paper. He gave me a physical paper, and I wrote the application. Where is your photocopy of my credentials? He took it from me, stapled it, said, okay, you can go. So I left. And then one day, after about a month or two, my father goes to the Ministry of Education. I say, his headmaster, he normally goes there. And comes back and says, Fidelis, you have been posted. You have been employed. You have been posted. So I posted to social school to go and teach mathematics and physics. That was how I got my first employment. I never knew anybody. I never talked to anybody.
Do you think your dad had an influence?
No way. Do you think he was not the type to influence anything for you?
So because it seems like he went there and he sorted things out and he came back and he told you. That's what I'm getting for.
He saw it on the board. He was the one who believed that if you cannot get it by merit, remain there.
Are you serious?
He was that type of headmaster who so much believed in merit that if you are not able to get it by merit, you stay there.
But that's how you are, Daddy. That's how you are.
So his influence in it was totally out. And to all my friends whose father, they all got posted, all my set, all you needed to do was to go and submit your credential. Because you said there was a plan. They knew how many science physics teachers they will need in the next 6 years.
Wow.
I did my education training free of charge. They knew how many science educator teachers they will need in the next 6 years. They encouraged them.
And they trained them. Yeah.
Yes, they tracked their project. As soon as they left school, they applied and they posted them. So there was a plan. And you didn't need to go and bribe any government official to be employed to be posted. You didn't need to.
Oh.
And then later on, when I went back to University of Benin to go and read computer science and graduated, I went to Lagos, and the choice was, should I have gone to apply to the, at that time, that was the era of merchant banks. There were so many merchant banks at that time.
Yeah.
So later on, those merchant banks, they evolved and they became merged with the commercial banks. So, and a lot of multinational companies to the country at that time, because at that time, labor was very cheap in Nigeria and there was industrial peace. There was infrastructure.
There was a government that supported investment and foreign investments.
Yes, there were foreign investment. Those were the eras when they built the refinery, they built the steel company, they built the power generating plants that we are still using today. Those were the era.
What was security like then? Like, you know, traveling on the highways, interstate travel within the city. I'm sure there was crime. You know, there's always some sort of crime, but like, what was it like?
It has never been so bad. So that was the era you had the Lozero's buses.
That traveled at night. Wow.
Yes, that was the era when, because of the relative security, people prefer to travel overnight. So if you had something to do in Lagos either from Warri or Port Harcourt from anywhere or Nicha, you basically took the night bus, and by 6 a.m. you were in Lagos. You came out of the bus, found your way to the office, you wanted to do your business, finished, and came back to and traveled back to Onitsha or to the east or
that same day,
by the following day. So it's not as if there was no crime. And I remember our time in Warri at that time. 1 a.m. we could move about, and there were expatriates in Warri at that time who drove all over the place. Warri and Port Harcourt, they were expatriates who drove themselves, who lived normal life, who went to market, who went to bars. 1 a.m. they were still out
drinking. Yeah, now an expatriate in Nigeria has to have a mopo and security following him or her everywhere they go.
Even at that, it's still very risky.
Yeah.
So something has definitely gone wrong that has put a big cut in our psyche as a people. So it's not, there was always crime, but at that time, if a robber was caught, we had famous robbers at that time. There were particular robbers like Aneni of those days. Aneni was even a recent phenomenon. In the 60s and 70s, you knew that this particular gang of robbers, this was the name of their leader, and the police is after them. And when they were caught, it was news all over the place that this particular gang had been caught. There were petty thieves coming to steal bicycles at night, and then when people shout, they run away. Mm. It was not as violent as at that time. The cattle rearers, the herdsmen of that time, were not an issue. So they came into the villages. If they came into the villages, they were given a place to sleep. The next morning, they move on.
It's they didn't come in to kill and destroy people's lives, you know.
Those things never happened. So the way things have just terribly, the cattle rearers have always been part of itinerant Nigeria. They were always
right, because they are nomadic people. You can't tie them down. You know, and what they offer is essential for us. We love cows. If there's any wedding, any burial, meat, beef is a part of our diet. So it's like, for me, it's not a thing of chasing them away, but it's a thing of they've always been there. Why did they become sort of violent all of a sudden in this way?
Yeah, so that's why I said that we all should always separate the facts from the emotions. The traditional nomadic cattle rearer,
yeah,
has not changed. What has changed is that evil objectives have used that means, mm-hmm, to commit crime. So if you see the average Fulani cattle, aboriginal one, he's still interested in his cattle with his stick, roaming all over the place. But political crime, criminals have, it's like using that medium to perpetrate crime, hiding behind it. Yeah, exactly. So the herder farmer clash that we hear of these days was never there. If you have your cassava, because cassava was the staple crop in they left the cassava farm and went to the grass. We never had this complaint. So it was in the last 10 to 15 years that all these type of things began to show up. So they existed among the people. People used to say Gambari Gbegwere. The generic name is Gambari. That means in the evening he sleeps. Then in the morning he brings us his prayer mat. And by the time he folds his prayer mat, he's gone. So he has tied his mat and gone. So the generic name was to call, say, Gambari Gbegwere. That means he has tied his mat to move, you know. So they ask for water, which they fill the jerrycan of water for them. They move on. They branched, they bought bread, tied it in their bag, and they moved on. So it's that era, what I would call the era of innocence, the innocence of the country. But somewhere along the line, struggle for power, politics, then the criminals and political talks now found a way behind those nomadic culture to commit crime, you know.
Mm. Mm. I think this is the best analysis I've heard, because usually when it's being spoken about, it comes down to, you know, sometimes Christian versus Muslim, then it comes down to the hatred. But I think you're really explaining it and seeing it for what it is, that it's really just hijacking what was always there before, right? As opposed to, you know, one person. And I think that's something that Nigerians, right? Like, you know, you talked about the fault lines and the, you know, tribalism. It's like we always see things as is us versus us, like, oh, it's the Igbos versus these people, it's the Ijaws versus these people. Whereas, like, if we take that aside and really think of the fact that we're all related, we're all close, you know, we have, even amongst our languages, right, we have similar words, we have similar things, we're very much alike. If you replace language, and so it's really a good way to see that and give perspective. So it doesn't make you now hate Catoreras, right? You know, the way that you've explained it, but to really see it for what it is, that it's this sort of other players that are involved in this.
Indeed, absolutely.
Yeah, but in the time that you were growing up, this is just aside from the politics of the country, but in the time that you were growing up, right, in the 70s and 80s, it was also a time of like very big you know, change in the music, in the arts, right, in the dressing. So were you more of just a, you know, go to school, focus on your computers, or did you also partake in the music of that time, right? Because there was Fela, there was I think there was Rex Lawson. I never heard their music, but I read it in books. There were all these people, there was sort of like the nightlife coming up. So how was that like in Benin, and also like when you moved to Lagos?
Okay. So you reached an interesting area. Yeah, I mean, it would be naive to say I was a very straight jacket from home to school to home and all that. That would be very wrong. We had our own rascality. Music has influenced on anyone who grew up at that time.
Yeah.
And 60s, the whole of the West African subregion was just covered by what you call high life music.
Yeah.
Yes, high life was a very moving, persuasive. And the beauty of high life was that predominantly indigenous language, it was sung in indigenous languages.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned Rex Lawson, who was a very famous person at that time.
Yeah.
So they were other all kinds of bands. From Ghana, the Gold Coast, down to Nigeria, and even as far as Congo, Brazzaville, high life was the swing of that era. Of course, we had the rock and roll, with Western influence, Elvis Presley at that time, later on, this man who sang I'm Black and Proud, so James Brown.
Yeah.
But predominantly the musical sports was high life. And we still enjoy the high life today. And it ran across the West African sub. What language you used to sing it, it was
beautiful. You just always dance, yeah.
It was always there. So people enjoyed high life. Now you talk about Fela. Fela has always been Fela from the 60s, he was there as the Kola Lobito band. Of course, he schooled, he learned his music in the United Kingdom, came back, he started with High Life, the Kola Lobito band. Then later on, he now evolved the High Life into what you call Afrobeat. So right from the 70s, Fela has been a big influence in Africa. He has been a big influence, and his music was satirical, political satire, social satire. Music like Zombie that satired the idiocy of the military at that time, which they banned. Then music like Lady, which satired the Western oriented Nigerian women at that time. Then we had music, what do you call the liberation music of people like Sonny Okoso, who sang about new colonialism, apartheid. And it became so successful that the independence struggle of Robert Mugabe and Joshua Nkomo in Zimbabwe at that time was inspired by the music of Sonny Okosu and his likes. So we were playing liberation music. If you listen to Sonny Okosu, you will see how passionate people were at that time about the freedom of Africa, Africa being free of colonialism. It was said that during most of the battles in Zimbabwe at that time, between the late Robert Mugabe and the Robert Mugabe on one side, Joshua Nkomo also fighting for independence, and the British forces, that the inspiration came from the music of people like Sonny Okosu. The same with the apartheid South Africa. So it was an era of very and that, you know, and the thing about the music is that even if it was a love song, it with the people.
Yeah.
So there was music like Yellow, Yellow, Yellow CC, Sit Down for Corner, Waiting in the Final. So the music was beautiful. It was folk music being romanticized, being played out, and people identified with the music. It was indigenous songs. Then, of course, it didn't mean that the Western music were not coming in. Later on in the 70s and 80s, we started hearing people like Bonnie M, the ABBA people, what's her name, Dolly Parton, Don Williams, who is in the metal music. At that time, we were already in school. It was fashionable to have a cassette player. I don't know if you ever saw a cassette player. It's not even a CD player, not CD, cassette. You use cassette, put in cassette.
Yeah, I think I saw a cassette player. The boxes, right? They're like a black sort of, you know, big. I don't know if I can describe it, sort of this black.
You never had the whole cassette collection. Hi. So in the morning, it was fashionable when you were in the dormitory to put a Don Williams or Dolly Parton in the morning. Or you put Jim Reeves. If you wanted to see religious at that time, put Jim Reeves in the morning. So, yeah, and then that was the era when a lot of discos were open.
Discos. I
see. Just going. Mainly from nowhere, reggae music came onto the scene.
you make it sound like that was a sad time.
No, it wasn't a sad time. It was a crazy time.
Okay.
But please, Iroy, Uroy, all kinds of music, and it was a viral influence. And of course, at that time, Michael Jackson was also there. Michael Jackson was always there from the 70s into the 80s, into the 90s. So it was a beautiful era. And I remember at that time, myself and Brother Godwin, when we were on holidays, I would go and meet him in Agbaru. Then there was this cinema at that time. They would show, you know, cinema was not the way you do cinema now. It was just a structure with a zinc cover, then a white screen at the end. Then
interesting.
They at the gate. They just make sure they cover it so that people don't spy the cinema. They put a big screen. Then we sat on the ground to watch the movie. After the movie will last. Maybe you saw this Western Wild Wild West, the cowboy movies. And then later on Chinese movies. They were always fighting and playing karate in those movies. When they finished the movie, they removed the white screen. The DJ brought his sound music. And then he converted to a disco. You start dancing.
That's funny.
So reggae was so popular that there was this story in Agbara at that time of a fight broke out in one of the discos, and they tried to separate the fight. So the DJ said, "Ah, wait a minute, why are we boarding us trying to separate this boy?" And so that time Uroy's music was so popular that the DJ went to play the music, and the stopped fighting and went to dance.
Wow.
It was a beautiful era.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful era. But then what did the music culture of that era, it kind of isolates you and insulates you from what we now see. Because you recall that the content in that era mattered. I've told you about the high life, why this, how they sang folk songs. I've told you about the liberation music of people like Sonny Okosu. I've told you about the satire, political, social-political satire of Fela.
Yeah.
So the content matters. See, today, if you still play Fela music, it's still relevant.
It's painful.
Because the content was important. Today, if you still play Rex Lawson's High Life, it is still relevant. Today, if you still play Sonny Okosu, the very issues, social-political issues they were talking about at that time, they are still relevant. So, and then later on, when Bob Marley came with his philosophy based on the underlying principles of Haile Selassie, freedom for the black man, and all those things, it made sense. So, if you grew up in the last from the 70s into the early 2000s, that space of 30 years, with that music, with content, it kind of insulates you from the music of this era. Where the content doesn't seem to make any. Somebody says,
it doesn't work.
Yes, that I will send $2 billion to your account just because I like it. Those things don't make sense.
It's true. I think even the romantic songs of that time sort of had like this purity of intent, you know, like, you know, maybe there was a beautiful girl and this guy showed interest, but now, like, some of the lyrics are just even unspeakable, and it's just gotten worse. But something I'm curious about that is, like, during that time, during the military rule, what was the sentiment like? Because I don't think it's fair to say that, like, the military governments were all bad. They still functioned, right? They still ruled. They still led the country. But what were the sentiments like? What were the hardships that people faced that made them say, oh, no, we want democracy? And, you know, I was reading or listening to a documentary, actually, by BBC, but a bit later, just record-keeping. I actually listened to an audio. It's called BBC Archives. You can find it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And it was the phone call that MKO made to the BBC after declaring himself president when they came to arrest him. So he said, oh, they're at my house. They're about to arrest me. I just want the world to know. And hearing it in his own voice, I'm just like, that's really what makes the developed world developed, right? Record keeping. It's one of the things that can change anybody, that's changed the world, just keeping record. But it was amazing to hear that. So what were the sentiments then from the people like?
Okay, so even the Abiola incident, which is the June 12, 1993 issue, is an event.
Right.
But before then, there have been a lot of socio-political evolution that culminated in that incident. So that June 12th issue was a climax of an internal struggle in Nigeria for power. So of course, you, as a 1993, that will be your history, but it goes way back. Nigeria's independence came in 1960. We had the three regions with three premiers, and they were basically quasi-independent with a federal government led by Tafawa Balewa. And then later when we became a republic, Zeke became the ceremonial head of state while Tafawa Balewa was the minister, prime minister. So, of course, between those three regions, there was a lot of rivalry among the leaders. And that rivalry, and it's important to know that countries like Australia have continued to maintain that model we had in the 60s. In Australia,
the ceremonial head of state.
Yes, this premiers with a central prime minister, with the queen as their head of state. That has not changed. And they have developed very, very well on that model. Now, because of the adventurism of certain military leaders, I'm one who's continuing to think that the biggest mistake we made was interrupting that civilian rule of the 1960s. Because of the adventurism of military leaders, the coup of 1966 happened. It was an unfortunate coup. It shouldn't have happened. The politicians quarreled, but they always find a way to meet each other at the middle. Awolowo was there developing the Western region on the basis of free education.
Education, yeah, at a very fast rate.
Yes, he was the first to establish a regional university, which is now the Obafemi Awolowo University. So, Nnamdi Azikiwe was there, also developing it. But later, Michael Okpara, when Michael Okpara took over, and Nnamdi Azikiwe became the head of state. And of course, the Saduanos also there as the premier of the northern region. And they were more agrarian. They focused their attention on agriculture and their cash crops. So each of the regions had their strategy. The East basically based their own strategy on entrepreneurship, trading, buying and selling, indigenous manufacturing. They did that. Then later on, the Western region came. So the sentiments was one of, you know, enthusiasm, competition, rivalry, and then negotiation at the federal level. They negotiated everything. Of course, the military adventurism came in, and those unfortunate coups of 1966, and later the counter coup came in, which later came in 1967. So that became a pall, a very dark pall around Nigeria. Now, after the Civil War, people were exhausted. There was need to reintegrate everybody. That was 1970, which is one of the reasons the federal government introduced the National Youth Service Corps. It was a vehicle to integrate the young people. But I personally think that the NYSC itself has lost its true essence, because at that time, in 1983, when I did my youth service, your choices were limited. Once you were posted, you were posted. I mean, of course, the country was safe that time. People in the south were posted in the northeast and west. So you didn't say, okay, I can't go to northeast, I can't go to south. You were even and experienced such things. So after the Civil War, the sentiments were of integration, reunification, and then, of course, everybody coming together. And then, led by Gowanda, began some very ambitious national plan. That's when they began to plan for steel, began to plan for developing our oil, they began to plan for petrochemical, they began to plan for to build power. So you had 10-year, 25-year development plan by government. And then the civil service was very, very professional. It's not as if there was no corruption. There was corruption. I mean, if you read Chinua Achebe's A Man of the People, it documents the corruption in the civil service at that time. But it was not as pervasive as we now see in every sector of our government at that time. So that was a lot of enthusiasm going on. Again, military adventurism interfered with Gowon's government, led by Muritala, and then Muritala, who was short-lived, Obasanjo came in, and then later on, Obasanjo handed over to Shehu Shagari. And of course, Shehu Shagari was trying to unite it. So party politics came back again after the interruption of the initial one, where we had political leaders like Awolowo, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Tafawa Balewa, Tony Nahoro, etc.
Do you think that there could have been better reparations for the Igbo people following the Civil War?
I think we need to revisit the issue of integration. There's still a lot of disgruntled feelings around that issue, especially in terms of the fairness of access to federal resources and appointments. I think that a lot of things are very lopsided. I think in the last 8 to 12 years, matters have not been properly addressed because people have no fair access to federal government resources. For example, in agriculture, the federal government is doing a lot of work giving loans and grants to farmers, but that it is not national. It is favoring a particular section of the country, and people are left out. So then in terms of federal appointments, although there is the principle of federal character, but in many cases, it is respected, and in some cases very covertly, very overt, flagrantly thrown away. Sense of marginalization, which you cannot ignore. Yeah. There's a sense of marginalization, especially from our Eastern brothers and sisters. There is a sense of being left behind. There's a sense of a section part of the country dominating political leadership. There is a sense of second class consideration and tokenism. We are giving you this appointment or this position or this consideration as a token. You don't deserve it. So there is a whole sense of, so, and that is what is causing so much anger. If you see the intensity of the anger about among the youths, especially in the South and in, the anger is so much that sometimes you ask yourself, what is at stake here? And you look back and say, this generation of people have never really known what it means to have good governance.
Yeah.
They have never known good roots.
Yeah.
In the last 20 years, they've grown up, they are in their 20s, maybe up to 25, 20, 27. And in that period, they've never known good roots. They've never known steady light. They've never known any steady means of. So there's nothing at stake. And not just in the Southeast, even in the North. The level of poverty, the level of what you call the Almajari syndrome in the North.
Yeah.
So if you go to the North in the morning, you see young children coming out to beg for food. And you ask yourself, why are you exposing these young children to this type of life at this age? And then they grow into their teenage years, into their 20s.
Become very violent, yeah.
Exactly. So that's what Karl Marx called the industrial reserve army. They become a reserve army that are susceptible to any extreme ideology. You can easily be recruited into any ideology.
Yeah,
very easily. So it's actually a Nigerian problem. The coloration in the Southeast is about neglect. The coloration in the North, whether or not it's about a situation where from ab initio, a feudal system does not allow the children of the poor the social mobility in the social ladder. Mm. So they have no means of climbing up. They're just there.
Mm.
Begging right from their youth until they become violent adults. So it's a very sad situation, and it's a very fundamental thing that we must talk of peace and security in the country.
Yeah, I think making changes to like access to education is something that is going to be, that has to be super important, because, you know, even hearing you talk about computers in your, you know, that in a way that's what research looks like, you know, coming to the US and seeing research being done, having the opportunity to be like able to advance science and be at that interface where you are basically discovering things that, you know, have never been discovered before. And you being in Nigeria, you know, those years seeing that, that's so important. Like, it does something to your mind. Whereas now, you know, going to schools in Nigeria, you know, even the problem of cultism and all those things. I watched a movie, More and Me, and it was shot at Obafemi Awolowo University, very recent movie on Netflix, by Kunle Afolayan. And they did like a shot of the university. And while I was watching, I'm like, this school is very beautiful. Like, it's so easy to see that it was planned for. Like, the halls, the design, the architecture, like, the way it's designed is supposed to, you know how those monasteries were designed to bring you into a sense of awe? That school was designed to make you want to study, you know, bring it, just the designality. I didn't know that Nigeria had anything like that. So it's sort of like a decaying structure now, but I was still able to piece and see, wow, this is a school, this is a university, this is, so now I can understand when people are shouting, oh, great Ife, like, it finally made sense. But I saw that in a movie and I was like, okay, I see why it must have been a great school then, you know, and all that. So it's really just sad to hear what's going on. But you seem like, I mean, I have questions. One is like, why didn't you ever get into politics? But aside from that, why are you still so sure that things can be better?
Yes. I always say that I've never been more hopeful.
Hey, thank you so much for listening. So if you've gotten to this point, it means that you went through the whole episode, or this portion of the episode. Thank you so much for listening. Please leave a comment or a rating and share, right? That's how we grow. We grow when you share. We grow when you're talking about it, when you're posting about it. Use the hashtag conversations with Ruki. Feel free to DM me at this Ruki and just let me know what your thoughts are and continue the conversation. Thank you, and wait for part 2.